Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello, everyone. This is Nick Peters with the Deeper Waters Podcast, and we're here for another great episode. Let you all in with a little housekeeping first. Some of you might have been wondering about how my grandmother-in-law is doing. She's still with us. My wife tells me she's a fighter, and apparently she is, and we're just thankful for every single day, but please keep praying for our family. And for those interested, the Mike Lacona show is scheduled now to be in 2 weeks. Since he had to reschedule last week, but we're very thankful that James Hannum came and filled in the gap. Now, today's show, we're going to be talking the first hour about Islam, since my guest is only able to be here for an hour, but that's okay. And then the rest of the time, you'll probably have to try and stay awake as I share some of my thoughts on certain matters. But my guest today is from Stand to Reason, and that is Alan Shlimon. And I hope I got it right this time. I've been trying to practice. Did I get it right?
Yeah, I'd say close enough. And the good news is, even if you say it wrong, nobody really knows. So you're in good shape.
Okay. Now, Alan, tell us about yourself. Why should my audience be listening to what you have to say today?
Well, we're talking about the topic of Islam, which the reason why this is important is because Muslims represent a very, very large number of people who adhere to a religion that we would describe as a false religion.
Yeah.
So we're talking about 1.5 billion Muslims. This is the second largest world religion. So after Christianity, you have, which is about, I would say, maybe around 2.3 billion people who are Christian adherents. Muslims are about 1.5 billion. So we're talking about here the second largest world religion after Christianity. And from a missions perspective, they're the largest unreached people group. So since we're talking about that, that's why I'd say we should care about what I'm about to talk about, because these are people who desperately need to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ.
And how did you get involved in this field?
Well, it's a combination of a couple of things. One is I work for Stand to Reason, which, as you know, and maybe some of your listeners might know, we're about creating a certain kind of person, and that is an ambassador. And so our main, the verse that I think probably most captures what we do is 2 Corinthians 5:20, which says, where Paul is saying to the Corinthians, we are all ambassadors for Jesus Christ, as though God were making his appeal through you. And so we ask, well, what does that look like? What does it look like to be an ambassador for Jesus? And we say it entails three things: knowledge, wisdom, and character. And so at Stand to Reason, what we're about is creating a certain kind of person, an ambassador, that has who has developed skills in those three areas, knowledge, wisdom, and character. And since we're an ambassador representing the message of Christ to a foreign people group, namely that is all non-believers, it seems critical for us as Christian ambassadors to be knowledgeable not only about the message of the gospel, but also about the belief systems and religions of other people in this world that don't adhere to Christianity. And since Islam is one of them, we felt it necessary that we begin training believers to know and understand something about Islam and about the Muslim people so they can reach them. Now, when that first kind of became a bigger issue, especially after September 11th, I think Stand to Reason kind of logically saw myself as the person who would be taking that particular subject and specializing in it. And part of it has to do with the fact that I'm Middle Eastern myself.
Yeah.
My family are not former Muslims or anything like that, but we are, as I was telling you off the air, Assyrians.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is not to be confused with Syrians, which are from Syria today, but Assyrians, which are from the nation that doesn't exist anymore called Assyria, which was destroyed in about 722 B.C. Mm-hmm. And Assyrians, you know, historically were the enemies of Israel, and unfortunately for my situation, enemies of God. But over time, they eventually converted to Christianity. In fact, it's rumored that disciples of Thomas, so who was a disciple of Jesus himself, but apparently disciples of Thomas went to the Middle East and converted the Assyrian people from kind of their, you know, non-Christian beliefs and, you know, non-following God beliefs to Christianity. And it's said that actually the Assyrians became one of the first people groups as an entire nation to accept Christianity kind of wholesale. And so since around the 2nd and 3rd century, Assyrians have been Christian. And so anyway, so my family grew up in Baghdad and Iran as well, and were Christians and had, you know, churches and stuff. So we kind of grew up in a situation, an environment where we were routinely around Muslims. And even having come to the States and living in the States most of my life, my family has been routinely involved with Muslims in the Middle East. My father routinely travels to the Middle East for work, and Muslims come from the Middle East and stay over at my parents' home. And so we just have just been regularly interacting with Muslims for a long time. And so it just kind of became a natural fit that I would be the one at Stand to Reason who might focus on this particular topic.
And for those interested, if the name Stand to Reason sounds familiar on this show before, it is because back in March we had Greg Kokar come on here as well. Next month, in fact, we'll be having on July 6th, J. Warner Wallace come on. And then on August, you'll have your other colleague, Brett Kunker, come on. So we're getting the whole team here, and we really appreciate them taking their time. And str.org is a place to go if you're interested in Stand to Reason resources. Now, getting to Islam, what essentially in a nutshell is Islam exactly for our audience?
What is it in a nutshell, you said?
Yeah, I mean, if you were trying to describe Islam to people and they didn't really know much about it, how would you describe Islam?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, Islam, as I mentioned earlier, is the name of the religion. Muslims are the adherents who follow Islam. And as I said, Islam is the second largest world religion, so it's a very successful religion in that sense of the word. And I'd say it's principally a works-based system of salvation where its adherents try to follow the commands of Allah, who they believe is the one and only true God. Now, Islam is an exclusivistic religion in the sense that it believes that it is the only true religion and all other religions are false. So just like Christianity, we would say the same thing. We'd say, well, no, there is only one true religion, and Christianity is the only true religion. So in one sense, you got to hand it to Muslims. At least they dispense with the nonsense of religious pluralism and postmodernism. So you got to give them credit for that. So that's good. But I would argue that ultimately Islam is a false religion that teaches about a false God. And it does teach about Jesus, but it teaches a false Jesus, and it teaches a false view of salvation. Mm-hmm. So it is for that reason why we as believers should be concerned about it, because here's a very successful religion who is very good at keeping its adherents within the faith, that not only teaches false ideas about God and Jesus and the afterlife, but literally has Christianity in its crosshairs. Meaning, it's not just another religion like we might say, well, there's Buddhism, there's Hinduism, there's Judaism, and you know, there's all these different religions. Yes, it's true, Islam is another religion, but it's the anti-Christian religion. Meaning, literally, parts of its scriptures, which it's called the Quran, which is about the size of the New Testament, that book, which is believed to be the word of Allah, according to Muslims, literally has chapters in it that are devoted to rebutting Christian doctrine, like the Trinity, or the resurrection, or the crucifixion, or the atonement. So it literally has Christianity in its crosshairs in the sense that it's a kind of an anti-Christian religion.
Okay, well, if someone is a Muslim, though, what essentially do they believe?
Well, if they're a Muslim, they have they actually have a very clear way of describing this. They believe that there are five what they call articles of faith, or maybe about six, mm-hmm. actually, six articles of faith. And these are sort of essential doctrines that all Muslims have to believe in. So, for example, the first required belief in Islam is known as the belief in the unity of God. And, in fact, there's a chapter in the Quran, chapter 112, which specifically talks about the unity of God. And that is simply the idea that there is only one God, and that one God exists as one person. So this is a specific rejection of the Trinity. In fact, they think the Trinity, and to believe in it is to commit an unpardonable sin. So they have to believe that there's only one God, and that one God is a Unitarian God. They also believe in God's angels. This is a second article of faith. So they believe, just like Christians do, that there are these non-physical beings that are involved in administrating the kingdom of God. They also believe in God's prophets. So they believe that Allah has appointed certain prophets throughout all of history and throughout all of mankind. And actually, many of the characters in the Bible are identified as prophets in Islam. So, for example, they would say that Adam was a prophet of Allah. They would say that Moses was a prophet of Allah. They would say that David was a prophet of Allah. And they would even say that Jesus was not the Son of God, but was merely a human being, a prophet of Allah. And related to this doctrine that Allah has given these prophets to mankind, they say that these prophets, or many of them at least, have been given also divine revelation. So, for example, Moses, they believe, was given a divine revelation known as the Torah. So the first five books of the Old Testament, Muslims would believe, is actually a divine revelation from Allah, which is kind of on par with the Quran. And they would say that David, who we know as King David, they would say he was a prophet of Allah who was given a revelation also, and that is the Psalms. So they believe the Psalms, like the Torah, are a divine revelation of Allah. And they would say also Jesus was given a divine revelation, and this was called the Gospel. And so these three divine revelations, the Torah, the Psalms, and the Gospel, they believe are on par with the Quran. As true revelations from God. Now, I mean, I have to qualify that statement, because although they believe those divine revelations are from Allah, they would say that they've been corrupted. And so brings up some interesting challenges for us as believers, which I can address later. But this is another required belief by Muslims, and they have to not only believe in the prophets of Allah, but also that some of them have been given these books. And belief in these books is also required by Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And then two other beliefs that they have is the belief in the final judgment. So Muslims have to believe that at the end of time, all people on earth will be judged according to their deeds. And in Islam, they teach that there is this like scale, and that throughout your life, there are two angels that track all of your good deeds and all of your bad deeds. And at the end of time, your good deeds and bad deeds will be put on a scale. And if the good deeds outweigh the bad deeds, then you'll go to heaven. And if the bad deeds outweigh your good deeds, then you will go to hell. And so this is this other kind of required belief, that this accounting will take place. So there actually will be a resurrection even in the Islamic account of eschatology. So there will be a resurrection and everybody will be judged according to their deeds.
Mm-hmm.
And so they also believe in... Oh, go ahead.
No, I thought you were done. That's the last thing they believe in.
Oh, I was going to say, they also have a sixth belief. It's called belief in divine destiny, almost kind of like a predestination, and that everything that happens is sort of the divine decree of Allah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How do the five pillars of Islam fit into this?
Well, the five pillars of Islam are required behaviors. So these six articles of faith are are more like required beliefs. The, the five pillars are required behaviors. So,
okay.
for example, the first pillar in Islam is known as reciting the creed.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a short statement that affirms one's commitment to Allah and to Islam. And the creed says this: there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. So in Islam, they would say that all it takes to become a Muslim is to say that creed, and of course believe it sincerely. And once you confess that creed, then you have become a Muslim. You started your journey as a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first pillar. The second pillar is daily prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So Muslims are required to pray five times a day. At sunrise, at noon, at mid-afternoon, at sunset, and then also right before they go to bed. And they're required to face towards what's called the Kaaba, which is this approximately 30-foot by 30-foot kind of cuboidal structure in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, that they believe Allah asked either Abraham or maybe perhaps Adam to erect. And that's supposed to be the direction of worship. And so the reason why they usually face a certain direction is because they're trying to face the Kaaba, which they believe Allah has ordained to face when they pray.
Mm-hmm.
So prayer is a second required behavior, a second pillar in Islam. there's also the fast of Ramadan, which is a month-long fast where Muslims abstain from eating food or drinking or smoking. And it's basically to commemorate Muhammad receiving the Quran. So they believe, you know, Muhammad was a prophet and the Quran was a divine revelation given to him. And to commemorate this particular act, they fast during the daylight hours of each day for about, and they follow the lunar calendar, so it's not exactly a month that we would say, but it's around a month. They also believe in, or they also have to give alms, or you know what we would say is tithing. You know, although they only have to give about 2.5%, not 10.
Yeah.
but that money goes towards serving the poor and needy in their communities. And then the final pillar in Islam is known as the pilgrimage to Mecca, and this is a journey that Muslims must take to Mecca, Saudi Arabia. And they have to do it at least once in their lifetime, and it certainly accounts to become a very good deed. So obviously if you do this particular deed, it weighs very heavily in the final accounting of your good and bad deeds.
Mm-hmm.
But what they do is they travel to Mecca for about 2 or 3 weeks, and they perform a number of different rituals while they're there. Obviously they go to this Kaaba, which is in the mosque in Saudi Arabia, and they circle around it, and they, you know, bow towards it and prayer towards Allah. They do a bunch of other things, but it's a pretty expensive journey for Muslims, especially the ones that live in the United States, because you have to pay for travel and lodging. And if you look at, you know, a lot of Muslim newspapers here in the United States, you'll see these package deals, and they range up to several thousands of dollars in order to fly there and lodge and stuff. So it's a pretty big undertaking. But they do make exceptions, actually, for people who are either financially unable to pay for such a thing, or if they're physically unable to go that far. But otherwise, that's the fifth and kind of final pillar in Islam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all this comes, of course, through Muhammad, right?
Well, yes, I would say, most of what we know about these kinds of things was, at least according to the Islamic tradition of how it happened, was that, during a 23-year period of time that Muhammad lived, from the age of 40 to about 62 or 3, the angel Gabriel, they say, revealed to Muhammad certain portions or portions of the Quran over that kind of 22-year period. And so that is where a lot of this information is found in the Quran. But actually, a lot of the other details are found in what's known as hadith literature. And hadith is simply things that either Muhammad said, did, or approved of.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of as he lived, people would take note, either mentally or document things that Muhammad did. And after his death, all this information was eventually compiled by category. So everything that Muhammad said about prayer, or about marriage, or about war, or about, you know, journeying, or about health, or whatever, they categorized into these subjects and eventually kind of documented everything he said, did, or approved of. And that information has been compiled into what's known as hadith. And these are, you know, large volumes of books that contain this information. And I would say that the specific details of how a Muslim is supposed to perform a lot of this stuff is found in the hadith literature.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, a lot of what we know is called Sharia law, which is Islamic law that's implemented in Muslim countries, is based on hadith literature. Because this hadith literature gives real specific examples to the broad principles that are taught in the Quran.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, right now we're going to go and take our first break. When we come back, we'll be discussing some of the objections that Alan said are coming from Islam. And I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this.
This is Mike Lacona. Nick Peters is my son-in-law, and I'm excited to announce his new podcast in which Nick will discuss and have guests on topics related to Christian apologetics and dealing with disabilities. Nick has already interviewed apologetic stars such as Greg Kokel and Rob Bowman, and I know of other stars he's in the process of inviting. So be sure to check out Nick's new podcast.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We're here with Alan Shlomon. Shlomon, if you want to be our guest as well and ask a question, the call-in number is 714-242-5180. We're talking about Islam right now. And you said there was a number of objections that come in, and one that you mentioned specifically is the idea that the text has been corrupted, which, as someone who has debated a number of Muslims before, I'd say right alongside Muhammad as a prophet, well, not right alongside them, but they seem to pretty much give prophetic authority to someone like Bart Ehrman as well, to say, yep, the text has been changed over and over again. So, is this really the case, and how can the Christians answer the Muslims on this?
Yeah, this is a great question, and the reason why this is an important objection to understand and respond to is because it strikes at the heart of the entire Christian enterprise, which is to present the gospel of Jesus Christ to Muslims. And so, obviously, the source of that gospel message is found in the New Testament, specifically the Gospels, and you know, but Muslims say, well, that's corrupted, so we can't really, we don't really buy what you're saying. And so what I found is that every conversation you have with a Muslim comes down to one issue, and that is the issue of authority. Because at the end of the day, no matter what you do, if you're, you know, trying to present the gospel, or maybe you're using a tract, or maybe trying to talk to the Muslim about Jesus, or maybe you're trying to talk about confidence of salvation that they have or don't have, at the end of the day, every conversation is going to come down to the issue of authority. They're going to cite the Quran as the ultimate authority, and you're going to say, no, that's not it. It's the Bible. The Bible is the ultimate authority. And so you're going to end up with a stalemate, and because they're going to be saying that the Bible is corrupted, and you're going to say the Quran is not the word of God, and you just kind of go back and forth. And so the way that I deal with this issue, which, by the way, is the majority content of that book I wrote called The Ambassador's Guide to Islam, the majority of that book, which is, I think, part two of that book, is about the specific tactic that I want to kind of explain to you here, which is how to respond to this challenge. And it the way I respond to the challenge is based on this notion that what Muslims say and what Islam teaches are sometimes two different things.
Yeah.
And it turns out that although Muslims say the Bible is corrupted, it turns out that the Quran teaches the opposite, that the Bible is actually the uncorrupted word of God. Now, Before I kind of go further with this, I just want to offer a clarification here. I'm not suggesting that we use the Quran to prove that the Bible is the Word of God or reliable. I'm simply pointing out that in your conversation with a Muslim, oftentimes you're going to be faced with this challenge that they're going to bring up, which is they're going to say, well, I'm going to dismiss what you're saying, Mr. or Mrs. Christian, because the Bible is corrupted. And my tactic that I want to suggest is simply a way to remove this tactic as an obstacle to your presentation of the gospel. Mm-hmm. So it's just a way to kind of diffuse their objection. It's not meant to be like, hey, here's a way to prove the reliability of the Bible, okay? Anyways, having said that, I think there's two important concepts that are taught in the Quran that we can use towards our advantage. The first is that the Quran teaches that no one can change the words of Allah. And the second is that the Quran says that the Bible is an example of the word of Allah. And so if the Quran says that no one can change the words of Allah, and the Quran also says that the Bible is an example of the words of Allah, then by logical deduction, the Bible is the uncorrupted or unchanged word of Allah. And so the point that I'm trying to make here is that we can actually use the Quran as leverage to help show the Muslim that their objection is not legitimate. In fact, that what they're saying contradicts their own authority.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I'll just cite a couple of passages in the Quran. Surah, which, by the way, surah simply means chapter.
Yeah.
So surah 6, chapter 6, verse 115, surah 6, 115, basically teaches that no one can change the words of God. Okay, it says that none can change his words, you know. Surah 6:34 says the same thing. Surah 10:64 also says the same thing. It says there can be no change in the words of Allah. You know, so there's a whole bunch of passages actually that teach this concept that no one can change the words of Allah.
Mm-hmm.
The question then becomes is there passages that also teach that the Bible is an example of the word of Allah, or the word of God? And I'd say that there is. For example, Surah 4, 136, Surah 2, 136, and also Surah 29, 46 all say this. So let me just give you an example here. Surah 2, 136 says this. It tells Muslims to recite this statement, basically, or to believe this, and here's what it says. It says, say this, we believe in Allah, the revelation given to us, meaning to the Muslims, and to Abraham, to Ishmael, to Isaac, to Jacob, and the tribes, and the revelation given to Moses and to Jesus, and the one given to all the prophets from our Lord. We make no difference between one and another of them. End quote. So there you see the Quran saying, hey, look, you know, you have to believe in the revelation given to Moses and to Jesus, which, of course, is the Torah and the gospel. And then it says, you know, we make no difference between one or another of them. And so there's a number of passages that I highlighted in that book, and the three citations I just made just a second ago, that all teach the same thing. And so, therefore, you have a very straightforward argument. The Quran teaches that no one can change the words of God. The Quran teaches that the Bible is an example of the word of God. Therefore, according to the Quran, the Bible is the unchanged word of God.
Mm-hmm.
And since the Quran says these things, and they were written back in the 7th century, this tells us something about what the people of the 7th century, at least the Muslims of the 7th century, thought about the Bible, and that is that it was the uncorrupted word of God. Now, if in the 7th century the Bible was the uncorrupted word of God, according to Muslims, what can they conclude about the Bible today? Well, the very same thing, because the Bible has not been changed since the 7th century to today. We have manuscript evidence that shows that even before the Quran was even written, there are full copies of the entire biblical text. For example, Codex Sinaiticus, which was written or copied in the middle of the 4th century, 300 years before the Quran or Muhammad, that have the entire biblical text, and we can compare it to Bibles that we have today, and it's virtually unchanged.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the Quran and Muhammad come along in the 7th century, 300 years after that biblical text has been copied down, and say, oh, yes, the Bible is the uncorrupted word of God, well, then Muslims can be confident that the Bible that we have today is also the uncorrupted Word of God, because nothing has changed. You know, we actually even have texts where Muhammad himself attests to the reliability of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so this is one of the reasons why I wrote about this in that book, because it's such a central objection to our presentation of the gospel, and yet we have good evidence from the Quran to use towards telling the Muslim that, hey, look, you know, your own authority doesn't teach the Bible is corrupted, so why would you contradict what it says? And again, the reason why this works is because what we're doing here is we're pitting the Muslim against his own authority. You know, a lot. Oh, go ahead. Were you going to make a comment?
Yeah, I was going to say briefly, for some people who are interested in some of these things that you're talking about, I recommend some works. Ones that come to my mind, for instance, those just getting started, want to know about the Bible is handed down and such. A Student's Guide to Textual Criticism of the Bible by Paul Wegener is an excellent start for anyone. And heck, for those who have gone beyond, it still contains much valuable information. And The Reliability of the New Testament, that's a dialogue between Bart Ehrman and Daniel Wallace, edited by Bob Stewart, with several other comments in their excellent work. I'm sure STR has some great works on textual criticism of the Bible. So if you're thinking, you know, this argument sounds really good, but how can I back up those facts about the Bible? Those are the kinds of works you need to go to.
Yeah, that's really good, Nick. And actually, let me just clarify here. The thing about it is that we do have all this evidence, and many of the books that you cited are good evidence that the Bible is reliable. But the point I'm making is that if you just present sort of biblical reliability from these sources to a Muslim, in their mind, they are thinking to themselves, okay, why should I believe this Christian who is telling me stuff from, you know, other men's wisdom, when I have Islam, the true religion, telling me that this is false? And so this is why this particular tactic is effective, because what we're doing is we're not saying, hey, Muslim, listen to us Christians tell you something about man's wisdom and the reliability of the Bible. What we're saying is, hey, you Muslim, why don't you look to your own authority, the Quran, which you believe comes from Allah, and it's telling you that the Bible is a reliable source, that you should look to it and consider it as a source of information. And this is why, you know, I use the term leveraging. You know, we're leveraging a Muslim's commitment to the Quran to our advantage.
No, I agree entirely. I just want people to know where they could find out information about the early manuscripts and such, in case they were asking. You know, this is something that we do have to grasp, because here in America, this way of thinking can often seem so foreign to us, largely because I think we have such a great stock in individualism, where every man is his own and every man thinks for himself and such. But if you went to the Middle East, the traditions and what you've learned from great thinkers of the past is really what's most important, isn't it?
Yeah, it's true. And yeah, I mean, we are thinking based on a lot of things. We're kind of resting and standing upon the shoulders of other people who have had, you know, really good ideas and thoughts before us. Absolutely.
Now, when you present a case like this to a Muslim and you say that according to the Quran, the Bible is uncorrupted, and in fact, the Quran even has Muhammad telling his followers, if I'm correct, to go and ask the people of the book about what they claim, because the people of the book are the authorities. And when you present something like this, and if I'm wrong about what I said, you can show me, but when you present something like this, what do the Muslims usually say?
Well, I would say that the vast majority of Muslims that I talk to are what we would call nominal or cultural Muslims, meaning they don't read the Quran, they don't attend mosque, they don't know much about their faith, and so they're typically caught off guard in most instances with this, you know. Now, the ones that are a little bit more knowledgeable will be a little suspicious about your perhaps interpretation. So they'll say something like, well, you know, you can't really know what the Quran says unless you read it in Arabic, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so they'll question it because it seems so foreign to them to suggest that the Quran itself teaches that the Bible is reliable. But, you know, again, I think when you present the case, And if you have a Muslim who knows what they're talking about, they're more likely to take it seriously. So, for example, a few years ago, I was invited to speak at a maximum security state prison, for which is kind of at the border of California and Mexico. And I was invited to present how to witness to Muslims to a group of Christians who are a lot, you know, these inmates in a maximum security state prison. So I get to this prison, and I get through all the security, and I enter into the prison yard, and I'm with there with about, you know, maybe about 80 or so Christian Protestants who were going to hear my talk on how to witness to a Muslim. And so I give them my notes, because they were to go make photocopies of my notes for the afternoon's lecture. And they hand my notes to this other inmate who goes to make photocopies. Now, it turned out that that guy who was making photocopies of my handout was a Muslim himself. And so as he's walking to the photocopy machine, which, by the way, I didn't know they had photocopy machines in maximum security prisons, but I guess they do. As he's walking to the photocopy machine, he's looking at the notes he's about to photocopy, and he's thinking to himself, hey, wait a minute. Some Christian's coming in here to speak about Islam. So in addition to making photocopies, he goes and tells all the Muslim inmates in the prison yard, hey, why don't we come hear this Christian guy talk about Islam and see what he's got to say? So that afternoon when, you know, all the Protestants are coming into this room in the prison yard, all these Muslims come in as well. And so I went ahead and presented this case where I tried to show that actually the Quran endorses the reliability of the Bible. And at the end of it, I said, okay, well, are there any questions? And I noticed all the Christians were kind of pausing and not saying anything because they wanted to hear what their fellow inmates who are Muslims were going to say. So finally, a Muslim raises his hand in the back. Now, keep in mind, by the way, these are Muslims who are not your average, you know, Muslim on the street. These guys have a lot of time to read the Quran, to read the Hadith, to study Islamic doctrines. They know their stuff.
Yeah.
And all the while I was teaching, they were tracking what I was saying. So finally, a Muslim in the back raises his hand. He says, you know what? He goes, I guess I have to agree with what you're saying. And I said, you mean about the Quran not saying the Bible's corrupted? He's like, yeah, I agree with what you're saying. Okay. I said, well, thank you very much. Another Muslim raises his hand. And he says the same thing. He basically says, yeah, he goes, you know what? I haven't thought about this, but I see what you're saying, and I have to agree with you that, yeah, the Quran does not teach the Bible is corrupted. And then a third Muslim also raised his hand and said the same thing. Now, finally, there was a Muslim over on the other side of the room who was just furious. He stands up, and he literally shouts at the other Muslims. He says, brothers, what are you saying? How could you say that what this Christian is saying is true? And then he cites a passage in the Quran that he believes teaches the Bible is corrupted. And guess who comes to my defense? The Muslims. The Muslims tell him, sit down, brother. No, what you're saying is not true. The Quran does not see that does not say the Bible is corrupted. It just says that the Christians misinterpreted it. And so, you know, here I was where these Muslims were confronted with this, and they were saying, yeah, no, what you're saying is true, and they were checking everything I was saying as I was saying it. So now that doesn't happen all the time. I mean, you know, I mean that was obviously a more dramatic situation. But a lot of times Muslims either don't know how to respond to this because they're caught off guard, or many of them agree, yeah, that the Quran does not teach the Bible is corrupted. Right. And by the way, the point of this then is not to just stop there and, like, you know, be like, oh, I won that argument. The point of it is to say, okay, if the Bible then is not corrupted like you said, then let's take a look at what it says about Jesus. Let's take a look and see what it says about salvation. Okay. So the whole point of this tactic is to remove the objection about biblical corruption so that you can then present the gospel of Jesus Christ to Muslims and not have that objection come up every second. That's the point.
If only the cameras had been allowed in the courtroom, I would have loved to have seen what happened there. Did you have any conversions that day?
No, I don't know. I was there invited to teach, and after I taught, I was supposed to be teaching the Christians there. So after I taught that, you know, we have a limited time with the inmates there, and then they kind of take us out. So I did have an opportunity, though, at the end where the Muslims kind of came afterwards and we just sat and chatted for another 20 minutes. Nothing happened there by way of conversion that I know of. But the point that I was there invited for coming there was to help train the Christians, because a lot of these Christians have Muslims as cellmates. You know,
yeah.
They're in a very, very small cell with a Muslim for a very long time. You know, and so the point was, let's try to equip and train them so they have kind of an opportunity to be equipped to reach their Muslim inmates.
We're going to find out where we go from there when we come back for our last segment with Alan Schliemann here of STR. I'm Nick Peters, and we will be back after this break.
Hi, this is Justin Brawley of the Unbelievable Radio Show and Podcast, recommending another podcast to you. Nick Peters is a deep thinker, a friend of mine, and he has an inspiring faith. So you should listen to him and his excellent guests on the Deeper Waters show. So keep going deeper and keep getting wetter, I guess. Blessings, Nick. Keep up the good work.
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
And we are back. My guest is Alan Schliemann from Stand to Reason. Our number is 714-242-5180 if you want to call in and ask a question. We've got to the point now where we're going to assume the argument's been accepted that the Muslim agrees the Bible is uncorrupted. What then?
Well, then the whole reason that this even came up, as I was saying earlier, was because the Muslim typically will respond by dismissing your presentation of the gospel. And so now you have a clear opportunity to present the gospel. And and so I'm not trying to advocate any one particular approach. Like, some people like to use these tracts that talk about the prophets and how the prophets kind of all point to Jesus. Some people like to simply present the gospel of Jesus Christ as they would any other non-believer. Some people, including myself, like to ask Muslims about, you know, whether they can have confidence of salvation. You know, so the point being is that any one of these particular approaches of presenting the gospel can be supported by this particular tactic. So in other words, this tactic isn't really a method of evangelism per se. What it does is it supports any particular method of evangelism that you might use. So I'd say that once a person has then accepted this notion that the Bible is not corrupted, then I would say carry forward with whatever unique approach you use to present the gospel. And you know, just to kind of tell you what I do, I mean, I don't actually do anything kind of fancy or tricky or whatever. When I'm talking to a Muslim, or when I'm talking to a homosexual, or when I'm talking to a non-believer, I simply present the gospel message in the same way, really, to all of them. And then I kind of go where the conversation naturally goes after the words. So when I'm talking to a Muslim, I don't really do anything. You know, I know there's lots of different approaches, and I'm not, you know, trying to downplay any of them. I think they're fine. I think actually Muslim, you know, since every Muslim is different, different approaches can work for different people. And so if you have a particular approach that you use right now, just stick with it, you know. But the point is that eventually what's going to happen is they're going to question the reliability of the Bible, and that's why you can use this tactic. The reason why I go with the approach about the confidence of salvation is because Muslims typically do not have confidence that they will be saved. Because remember, they, you know, Islam is a meritorious-based system of salvation. And so that means that how well you've done, how well you've followed the pillars of Islam, how many good deeds you've done and how few bad deeds you've done will determine whether you go to heaven or hell. Well, most people can't really keep account of that. And so when I ask Muslim, hey, you know, are you confident that you're going to heaven? Almost all of them tell me no. They say, no, how could I have confidence of that? And that's when I find it a very natural way to say, well, you know, in Christianity we do have that confidence. That's what Jesus provides, you know, because we've committed crimes against God, and the reason that Jesus makes any sense in the whole gospel, you know, story, which of course I know you, Nick, and your listeners probably know this, but that is basically we're making a trade. God says, I will have Jesus pay the penalty for your crimes, and in return, you give me a lifetime of allegiance. You know, so, you know, given that trade, you know, God allows us to have Jesus kind of pay the penalty for our crimes, and that guarantees our forgiveness, and of course guarantees our salvation as well. And so that's something that Muslims don't have, and that's why I like to use that either as a conversational kind of opener or just at some point in the conversation talk about that, because it's a natural tie-in to presenting Jesus.
Mm-hmm. You know, we had a Nabil Qureshi who came on our show actually at the 1st of May. Yeah, you know him.
Yeah, Nabil's a good friend of mine. Yeah, we've actually roomed together a couple of times at different conferences around the country. Yeah.
Nice. And it's amazing how much that I'm hearing the same thing here, because he said authority, and then said, you know, the number one thing you can really press a Muslim on is salvation. Because even Muhammad in the Quran, if I'm remembering correctly, couldn't be guaranteed salvation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Go ahead.
He also was talking about how a lot of Muslims are coming to the faith, and often it's not just with our sharing the gospel, but dreams and visions that come to them.
Yeah, that's true. And probably Nabil shared his own experience. I interviewed him one time when I first met him. I think it was maybe about 5 years ago, 2008, at a conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I know his personal testimony includes that. I've talked to missionaries from different parts of the world when they come back to the States, or even some of them that I know right now who are abroad, who say a lot of Muslims are coming to faith in Jesus Christ because they see visions, you know? I've heard some people say, and this is really strange, but they say they've seen a dream where they see a man who they believe is Jesus, and then later on, either within the month, the Jesus Film Project comes to their town, and they see the movie, and the person in the movie is the person who they saw in the dream. And of course, it's the same, you know, Jesus that's depicted in the movie. And it's just really, really bizarre things like this, where we see God kind of moving in a spiritual way, in a supernatural way, I mean, to draw people, Muslims, to himself, which is really, really awesome.
Yeah, I think there are several stories that kind of nature as well in the book Eternity in Their Hearts, with Don Richardson describing missionaries who go to various places, and they find out that people have been told, oh yeah, we've been told to wait here, and for people who would come that would bring a book that would be a message from a great God and such. And it happens a lot in the Muslim world, because the Muslims really do take dreams and visions extremely seriously.
That's true. Yeah, they do. You're right. They do put a much higher premium on them than I'd say the average Westerner does. And so perhaps that's why God kind of uses that approach. I don't know. Of course, we can't know the mind of God, but certainly that would make sense.
Now, what were you going to say, though, about Muhammad and salvation in the Quran?
What was I going to say about that?
Yeah.
Oh, nothing. I was just affirming that, yeah, you're right. If I recall, I don't know the passage off the top of my head, but I think he says something to the extent of, you know, like none of us can know, you know, the fate of ourselves. So you're right. I mean, you know, obviously if you were to ask a Muslim, though, do you think Muhammad is in heaven with Allah, they would certainly say yes. In fact, Muhammad is considered to be the supreme example of what it means to be a Muslim. So even though Jesus in the Quran is described as sinless, Muhammad is not. But still, even given that, Muslims say that he is the supreme example. And in fact, he is considered to be, his life example is considered to be a source of authority. So just like, you know, Christians many times used to wear that wristband that would say WWJD, what would Jesus do? Because they thought that how Jesus lived was authoritative for us today. Muslims in the same way have what's called sunnah. And sunnah simply means, is a reference to the authority of Muhammad, and how he lived is a precedent for how Muslims are to live today. So,
and that would be where we get the name of a Sunni Muslims from, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I Yeah, I'm not sure how. Yeah, I mean, I think it is coming from the same word. I'm not certain about it. But yeah, there are Sunni and Shia Muslims derive their authority in different ways. The Shiites or Shia, I mean, the whole division between Sunni and Shia is about authority, also, actually.
Yeah.
And the Sunnis say, well, after Muhammad died, the person who should become the next successor to Muhammad should be someone who is elected by kind of the elders and the people who are in leadership in Islam. The Shia people said, no, it should be someone who is in the bloodline of Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, since Muhammad was divinely elected, we can't, you know, leave the next successor by a vote to a vote. You know, it should be someone who's in Muhammad's bloodline, and that would have been Ali, who eventually was the fourth successor to Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
But it's over that division that the Sunni and Shia split, because at the end of the day, it comes down to, again, to authority. You know, the Shiites believe that Muhammad and then Ali and then Hussein and Hassan and their 12 descendants are all part of a divine chain of authority, and whereas the Sunnis say no, it doesn't come from those 12 divinely appointed imams. You know, it comes from other sources. So again, even within their own kind of division, even within their own kind of infighting, the issue again is over authority. You know, so it's a very big deal in Islam.
I'm curious also when you present this approach that there are some matters that we'd say are, that they might say is, well, that's just your interpretation and such, you know, I think the Bible clearly teaches them and you can't really interpret it via race, such as the Trinity or the deity of Christ. I think the Bible does teach those and I'm 100% convinced of that. And if you go against the other way where you're just really giving bad interpretation, but I think the Muslim could try and find a way out of that somehow, but I'm kind of curious how they'd handle something that seems to be undeniable entirely. That'd be, for instance, the Bible teaching that Jesus was crucified, when that really goes against their beliefs.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's a great question. Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. Because you're right, once they have to acknowledge the Bible is not corrupted, then they have to challenge you on interpretation. And like you said, to somehow get from the Bible that Jesus was not crucified is a tough sell. You know, how would they do that? Well, there's two ways. One is, well, two things happen. One is, most Muslims don't deny that. They don't know how to deal with that, because you're right, the Bible is clear. However, some Muslims that are a little bit more maybe studied or have thought about this ahead of time, I see different kinds of things, but here's one example they'll say. They'll say, when Jesus was talking to the Pharisees and they were asking Jesus for a sign, what sign did Jesus give him? And the Christian might answer, well, he said the sign of Jonah.
Yeah.
And they say, that's right. And here's what Jesus said. No sign will be given to you except for the sign of Jonah, for just like Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days, so the Son of Man will also be in the earth for 3 days.
Yeah.
And then they ask this, did Jonah die when he was in the belly of the fish?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is no. And they say, see, even Jesus says that he's not going to die during those 3 days, because he says just like Jonah was in the belly of the fish and did not die, so Jesus was kind of in the earth buried but did not die as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll say things like that to try to make the case that, yeah, Jesus was not crucified, but instead he was taken up to be in the presence of Allah, you know. But again, this is really a stretch, and this is why, although the tactic that I was talking about might help you diffuse the charge of biblical corruption, you're still left with this charge that you're interpreting the Bible the wrong way. But as you can see, and as you've already pointed out, Nick, it's a lot easier to make the case that Jesus really did die, and he really did rise from the scriptures, than it is to try to argue for, you know, the reliability of the Bible. You know, because we're in a much surer footing to clarify what Scripture teaches from an interpretation perspective than we are to make a case that the Bible is reliable from a non-Quranic view.
Yeah, I mean, we could just as well say that Jonah wasn't in the earth for 3 days, and the whole thing just seems ad hoc entirely, and one of the greatest problems I'd have with it is it opens God up to the charge of deception, because he let so many people believe for so many centuries, apparently, that Jesus was crucified, and decided to come along in the 7th century and say, actually, he wasn't, even though that had been firmly established. And, of course,
right.
Even though they wouldn't accept it, we've got secular historians like Tacitus and others who say, yes, Jesus was crucified.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, yeah, it's deception. It's also, you know, entire theology is built on that, you know, because obviously with the whole crucifixion is the whole purpose. You can have atonement, and, I mean, everything flows from that. So you're right. It's like, wow, you know, God just let this continue for 7 centuries until it was allegedly clarified in the Quran, and which it's even actually doubtful in the Quran, because there's other passages where Jesus emerges from the womb and he's still a little child, and according to the Quran, he says this, he performs a miracle where he starts speaking as an infant, and then he even says, "Blessed is the day that I was born, and the day that I die, and the day that I'll be raised to life again." So there's also this like the statement that Jesus himself makes about predicting his future life, death, and resurrection. So there's even passages in the Quran that seem to contradict what many Muslims are arguing, you know. And there's also arguments about how to reinterpret the passage where it just says that Jesus didn't die, but, you know, it's a little bit more complex. But so you're right. It's a great point, you know.
Something that I think we should all be getting out of this as well is that when we're going and engaging Muslims, or heck, when we're going and engaging anyone of a different worldview, is that it's not enough to know what's wrong with their worldview. You have to know your own worldview well. And I'm sure you can point to several great resources, since we've only got a few minutes left, from Stand to Reason that can help my listeners with that.
Yeah, with regard, you mean for the context of Islam, correct?
Yeah, or anything else they want. But for Islam, what do they need from STR? What can you give them?
Yeah, I would say two things there's three things in general that we could probably point to. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the one that I'd mention is the book, The Ambassador's Guide to Islam, which is a very short book, by the way. It's only, I think, like 65, maybe 70 pages. So it's very accessible. Mm-hmm. You can literally read it in an hour or two. But I purposely made it that way because I wanted to kind of just put what I thought to be the essential tactic that can really support, you know, ministry efforts. So that's one book. We also have another book by Norman Geisler called Answering Islam, which he wrote with Abdul Salib, who is actually a pseudonym of a former Muslim. And then and that book is actually much more comprehensive. I mean, they both literally kind of go topic by topic and kind of really chronicle all the arguments for and against on every topic. So it's a little bit more extensive. And then we also have a William Lane Craig did a series of debates, against, I think, Shabir Ali and maybe another person. And that's a DVD set that we have at Stand to Reason called, you know what, now I can't remember off the top of my head. let me see if I can just pull it up real quick. But it's if you just go to our website and look under the DVDs section, you might find it. If not, you can always just call our office and just say, what DVD set do you have where William Lane Craig is debating Shabir Ali on a number of different topics? And that would be the one that I might that I would consider. Oh, here it is. It's called Christianity and Islam, A Series of Debates.
Mm-hmm. So that would be the other one. The Ambassador's Guide to Islam, I see, is available for $6.95. When you're interested, or you can download a PDF for $3.95. And I'm also thinking, we've got Mike Lacona coming here in a couple of weeks. He's got a great resource at Risen Jesus on the crucifixion and how it's kind of a catch-22 for Muslims. So that's another great source I'd recommend. But all the sources you've found about can be found at str.org, right?
Yes. The only one that we don't have that I also recommend is by another friend of mine named George Husni. It's called Engaging Islam, and I know it's available on Amazon for under $10. But he's been involved in reaching Muslims for years. He does translation work for different Bible organizations in Lebanon and stuff. So his book Engaging Islam by George Husni. Is actually one that I really recommend in terms of understanding the culture and understanding Muslims themselves, because he's just been immersed in that culture for many, many years.
That's available for $9.95 on Kindle and new ones for $14.66. But we definitely thank you, Alan, for taking your time. The hour's up, and I think you said you could only give us an hour, but I thank you for taking your time to be with us today.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Well, I enjoyed talking to you. It was good to meet you as well.
I enjoyed having And I'll still be here for the next hour, so you all try and stay awake out there and listen. And we're going to have some good discussion. And if you want to call in, the number is 714-242-5180. We'll be back after this.
Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grock as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told. Every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
I can't believe in you today. Oh, I can't close my eyes and make it go.
And we're back. And for the rest of the hour, you have just me here, Nick Peters. Unless you want to call in as well, and we can have a chat. And, you know, the lines are open. We can chat about any number of things. You can talk about Islam some more if you want to. I'll try and answer some questions. If there's something else on your mind, some topic about the Bible or something that you're just wondering something about, the call-in number is 714-242-5180. We also have a chat room open. And I'd like to tell you all that next week I'm honored to get to have John Walton to be our guest. You might not know who that is. He is the author of a book, The Lost World of Genesis 1. And according to John Walton, when we've been reading Genesis and we've been getting into debates such as the age of the earth and topics like that, we've been getting it wrong. That Genesis 1 is not about that in any way. How does he explain that? Well, it's a fascinating read, and I'm sure it's going to be a fascinating interview. We got a lot of good questions for him, and I hope you'll be there to join in as well. And like always, you can call in 714-242-5180 at day. So be going to Amazon if you want to. Get your copy of The Lost World of Genesis 1, and then you can join in. Now, something that I talked about when Alan was here, and I can't stress this enough, is that when you are out there engaging someone who is of a different worldview, or heck, even a different interpretation of Scripture than yours, not as serious, of course, as long as they're Orthodox, but if they're of a different position, what you need to know most is what you believe in your own position. And there are so many Christians that don't know this, and they are just caught flat-footed. And it's a shame when the objections that we come across really are incredibly weak. And I say that as one who does read the material that I disagree with. There's weakness out there. When you read the liberal scholarship on the New Testament, for instance, there is rarely interaction with evangelical scholarship. And it just shows through and through. When I meet people who consider the New Atheist as authorities, I just find myself thoroughly disappointed, and immediately I know this is someone who doesn't know what they're talking about. And yet this is the way our culture is going, because people are not thinking, people are not learning what they believe. if you are a Christian, you are claiming that God sent his only son, who is fully deity in the flesh, to come and die on a cross and rise again. You're saying God walked this earth for a little over 30 years. Maybe it's just me, but I think that's a little something worth learning about and knowing about. If the question of God does not really change your worldview too much, you might want to ask yourself how seriously you're taking the question of God. And this is something I have to ask myself regularly as well. I have to ask myself, why is it that this great truth that I'm out here defending, that there are so many times I just seem to lose sight of it? And I think we're all guilty of that to an extent. But the more we know this, the more it informs our lives, the better able we'll be able to function in the world and grow in the character of Christian holiness that we need to. Let's use an example of what we were talking about, the claim that the Bible has been corrupted. There are a number of people out there who used to be Christians, and when they talk about the Bible being corrupted and changed, where do they go to? Well, they go to Mark 16, 9-20, the long ending of Mark, and they go to John 7, 53 to John 8, 11, the story of a woman caught in adultery. Now, if you're reading this in a Bible like the NIV, for instance, a modern translation, you'll find there's a footnote, or these are in brackets, or somehow it's done, that says, this account is not found in the oldest and best manuscripts. You know what? That's true. That's entirely true. But yet, some Christians, in return, look at this and say, oh my gosh, the Bible has been changed, the Bible has been corrupted, and as soon as that happens, the floodgates are open. It's an entirely emotional case from then on. So, taking a look at this, say, does this indicate the Bible has been changed? Actually, no, it doesn't. See, if we had no clue whatsoever what the original text said, you might have something you could go for. But we can recognize that this is an addition because we have so many manuscripts of the New Testament out there. We have, in fact, what is usually described as an embarrassment of riches when it comes to the New Testament. We have so many manuscripts, thousands of them. The closest that we have otherwise is Homer's works on the Iliad and the Odyssey, and they don't even begin to come close. Not only do we have that, we have them in numerous languages. We have the Bible in Greek, we have it in Latin, we have it in Coptic, we have it in Armenian, we have it in Arabic, we have it in all these languages out there. And let's suppose we didn't even have that. We have quotations of a church fathers where, say, for a few verses, we could reconstruct the entire New Testament if we had to. Now, so many Christians will come and they'll bring out Bartram and talk about how the Bible has been changed with books like, misquoting Jesus and Jesus Interrupted. And really, Bart Ehrman has done the church a service. Because we have a topic now, like textual criticism, that is being discussed openly. And this is why I say I am very thankful when books like The Da Vinci Code come out, or when the New Atheists start publishing their books, because these are the kinds of conversations I want to be in the public square. I want us to be discussing the reliability of Scripture. I want us to be discussing the existence of God. I want us to be discussing the resurrection of Jesus. And now, when these people are doing their writings to try and destroy Christianity, they're just putting it out there in the open so I can say, hey, thanks for doing what I've been wanting to do. Get the conversation out there in the open. Now, for someone who does want to say that scholars show the Bible has been changed, I'd like to quote the works of a scholar who is a textual critic on this matter. I've got two quotes. This is the first one. If a primary purpose of this discipline, being textual criticism, is to get back to the original text, We may as well admit either defeat or victory, depending on how one chooses to look at it, because we're not going to get much closer to the original text than we already are. At this stage, our work on the original amounts to little more than tinkering. There is something about historical scholarship that refuses to conceive that a major task has been accomplished, but there it is. Which means, yeah, we've got close to the original text, about as close as we can get. There's just little bits of tinkering, and that's it. This other scholar also says, elsewhere, in spite of these remarkable textual, in brackets, differences, scholars are convinced that we can reconstruct the original words of the New Testament with reasonable, parentheses, although probably not 100%, close parentheses, accuracy. Now, who is this scholar that I'm quoting? If you think this scholar is Bart Ehrman, move to the head of the class, please. Yes, this is Bart Ehrman. The first citation is from the 1997 Society of Biblical Literature in San Francisco. The other one is in his book, The New Testament, A Historical Introduction to the Early Christian Writings, in the third edition, the one I've got. Yes, even Bart Ehrman's quoted with saying the New Testament is reliable in how it's been handed down. And we can largely thank Daniel Wallace for bringing this out very well in his book, or a book that he is taking part in, the Reliability of the New Testament, books edited by Robert Stewart. And for those concerned, yes, I've looked up the references. I've got the link to where Ehrman said what he said of Society of Biblical Literature. And yes, I've read Ehrman's introduction to the New Testament. So yes, indeed, this is what he says. In interacting with the other side, that's how you check. Because if we're going to go to people and say, we want you to examine Christianity and see that it's true, we need to be able to do that ourselves. I don't expect everyone necessarily have the time or the intellectual power to do that, but know that some of us are. And if you're out there and you're debating regularly, chances are you do have that, and you do need to be able to do that. And we need to also do this within our own house. I'm a member of some groups on Facebook that do Christian projects. We had someone ask recently, how would you discuss creation with a 9-year-old? And before too long, what happens? A debate on young Earth, old Earth comes out. And I step in. Now, I have my own view, but I said, look, here's the best thing you can do for this kid, okay? Tell her what the best minds at a group like Answers in Genesis thinks, and give why they think that. Tell her what the best minds at a group like Reasons to Believe and Old Earth group think. Tell her what people at BioLogos think. Tell her what John Walton thinks. Present all these views little by little and say, see, there is disagreement in Christianity. Some Christians think this. Some Christians think that. And all of these views are orthodox and accepted. And then do something really strange, I know it sounds, but encourage the child to look for themselves, ask the questions that they want, and come to their own conclusion. This is something that is just so foreign to people. I say, look, if you're sure your position is true, you shouldn't have any trouble with doing that. And I gave the analogy of what I do in my own household. I'm Old Earth. My wife is Young Earth. I'm a Frederick. She's a futurist. But you know what? When she asked me a question like, what would a futurist think about such and such a passage? Well, I try to give the best answer I can. I'm not going to give a fake straw man about it's going to make futurism look ridiculous. I say, if futurism is false, and I think it is, let it be found false on its own merits, not because I have to give a bad view of it to make it false. It'll be false on its own. But I want that to be a conclusion that someone else reaches. And I'm not trying to get her to change her mind. I'm just saying, yeah, here's what it says. Here's what my perspective says. If there's time for questions, then ask those questions. And that's the way I'd recommend doing with this child in this case. Present all the views that you can and let the child decide. And note, in doing that, you're doing something incredible as well. You're learning about those views on your own, too. And you know, for all you know, you might change your mind. You might come up with views as an old earther, you'll leave a young earther. You might come holding John Walton's view, you'll leave with a view of Biologos. You could come with a young earth view, you'll leave with an old earth view. As long as you're open to the truth, what do you have to be afraid of? And as long as you're convinced that Christianity is true, what do you have to be afraid of? When I go on a regular basis, I go to the local university. It used to be a Bible college, but I go into the library and I check out a few books at a time and come back, and that's what I'll be doing for the next few weeks, is reading those books and go back and repeat the same process again. But when I do this, it is a great joy to know that I can get any book off of the shelves and be able to interact with it. I don't have to live in a little bubble where I'm only reading that which agrees with me. I've even been in dialogue with an atheist this week on Facebook saying, why aren't you out there being able to risk that your views might be wrong? Well, I risk that my views could be wrong every day. If I was scared to risk my views could be wrong, I wouldn't be debating with atheists. And if I was scared to risk my views could be wrong, I wouldn't be out there reading things that disagree with me, but lo and behold, I am. And really, it is such a blessing to you intellectually when you start doing this kind of thing, because you have someone come and they represent an argument that they think is a defeater. It's a knockdown. You have not seen this one coming at all. And for me nowadays, when this kind of thing is presented, I say, oh, that. Yeah, here's a blog article I wrote on it a while back that deals with this. And it is such a great way to deflate the sales of the people who come against you. Because the reality is, I find most people that I debate against, they're not too informed about their own worldview, and they're definitely not informed about mine. That most people who are criticizing Christianity really know very little about Christianity. All they have is the caricatures that they've got from people like, oh, Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris or Christopher Hitchens. And if they talk about textual criticism and the way the Bible's been handled, pretty much all they have is Bart Ehrman. You know, we've played the unbelievable promo here that we have from Justin Brierley, and he had Victor Stinger on his show one time during a debate. I don't remember who it was against, but somehow they started talking about the Bible in that debate, and I was just amazed because Stinger had said earlier on that when you're studying something, you shouldn't rely on just one authority. And you know what? He's absolutely right with that one. You should be looking for multiple authorities. But when it comes to the Bible, he says, oh, I rely on Bart Ehrman. And there was no other name given. I couldn't believe what I had just heard. And if there are other names given, I can tell you who they are. Dan Barker, Freedom from Religion Foundation. Or Robert Price, so far out there, who thinks that Jesus never even existed, is a valid position to hold, and that the creed in 1 Corinthians 15 is an interpolation. Nowadays, you could probably add Richard Carrier to the list, who also holds that Jesus never even existed. And those are pretty much, by and large, the authorities. Now, we might point to other people like the Jesus Seminar and such, but I'm really skeptical most of them have ever even read the Jesus Seminar. And if anyone's interested in knowing, yes, I have read the Jesus Seminar. I've read the five Gospels. I know what they say. I've read John Dominic Crossan. I've read Marcus Borg. I know what these people out here are saying. And I'm still going to be keeping reading these liberal writers out here because I want to know not just what I believe, but I want to know what the other side believes as well, so that when I'm going out there and I'm engaging, I will be ready on both ends. In fact, if you're out there debating, if you really think you know what the other side believes, the way to test this, could you make an argument that would be just as convincing, in many cases, if you were trying to play devil's advocate and argue for their side? Which, I think if you're going to do that, if you're going to go out there and do evangelism with people like this, you need to know how they would argue as well, so you'll be more than prepared to deal with it. Okay, we've got about 40 minutes left. It's our next break here, and I'll be back after this. The call-in number is 714-242-5180. Open mics. We can talk about whatever you want.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
Hi, this is Justin Brierley of the Unbelievable Radio Show and Podcast, recommending another podcast to you. Nick Peters is a deep thinker, a friend of mine, and he has an inspiring faith. So you should listen to him and his excellent guests on the Deeper Waters Show. So keep going deeper and keep getting wetter, I guess. Blessings, Nick. Keep up the good work.
And back at you, Justin, because I think the Unbelievable podcast is a great show for you all to be listening to as well. It's one that I try and listen to every week. And he just has so many good guests. If you want to learn how to interact, that's a great way to do it. And, of course, one of the best ways to learn how is to go out and argue yourself. But we also play the donation promo, and I have to stress this as well. Everything you're hearing here is supported by donations. None of us can do this stuff for free. The reason I'm able to bring you these guests and have informed interviews and such is because I have to be doing constant reading, constant study. If you follow me on a website like Goodreads, you'll find out that, yeah, this is what I'm doing. Usually when I'm done reading a book, I'll review it, I'll let you know what I think. I don't always do it, but usually I do it. And your donations go a long way. So please make some donations to Blog Talk Radio. And if you want to make some also specifically to Deeper Waters, you can do that from our website, a blog, sorry, that is. We're at deeperwaters.wordpress.com. You can make a tax-deductible donation also in two other ways. You can make one to tectonics.org. Just tell them that it's for us here at Deeper Waters. Or we also do work for Ratio Christi. We're part of the Issues. Well, actually, we are the Issues and Answers team. And your donations can be made there, and they will also be tax deductible as well, which will really help you out. Now, going with what I was saying earlier, I mentioned Carrier and Price, who both hold a position that Jesus didn't even exist. A few weeks ago, I got sent a question from someone about a Richard Carrier video where he did go after the existence of Jesus, and he mentioned a number of biblical passages in that talk. Now, I was on my way to the university there, which used to be a Bible college. They're still, think about the staff down there is still entirely Christian, and the library is still full of books about the Bible and such. So there's still a Bible emphasis there. They just don't go by the name of Bible College. And I had in my memory then all these passages that Carrier talked about. So what do? Well, I do something that I know a lot of people would really consider unusual to do. And that's, I went to the commentaries and I started looking up these passages. I said, I want to know what the leading scholars are saying about this. And when I was doing this, I was finding Carrier's positions just weren't holding water. And what I find usually happening is that he takes the case that's the least likely and treats it as if it's the most likely, it then goes from there. An example is, for instance, the idea that a passage in 1 Thessalonians 2 where it talks about the Jews in that passage, that's an interpolation. Yeah. There were a number of scholars that didn't even think that possibility was worth mentioning. In this kind of position, you just have to explain away so much. There's a reason New Testament scholars on all sides don't treat the idea that Jesus never existed seriously. It's extremely difficult. No, I'd say, in fact, impossible to explain the rise of Christianity otherwise. Of course, usually goes with this. It's this idea that ancient people really weren't that intelligent, didn't really know that much, such, and it's only we in our modern intellectual climate, especially with the help of modern science, that know better, to which I say, baloney. You know, I said I've been debating with an atheist this week, and when they bring up the objection about miracles, I say, look, the reason people in the Old Testament and the New Testament talked about miracles, it wasn't because they were ignorant of science. It was, in fact, because they knew some science pretty darn well. For instance, let's consider Mary and Joseph. Here we have this happy little couple, and they're practicing sexual fidelity, as we can expect in a Jewish context. They're engaged. The only thing that you didn't do when you were engaged in that culture pretty much was you didn't live together and you didn't have sex together. And so Joseph's going about his life, eagerly anticipating when he's going to get married to Mary. And then, lo and behold, here comes Mary. Says, Joseph, I'm pregnant. Now, Joseph is not an idiot. Okay? He was most likely certainly not a first-rate scientist of his day. He probably wasn't particularly educated in some way. But he's not an idiot. And he does two and he puts two and two together. He says, see, Mary is pregnant. I did not sleep with her. Therefore, someone else did. He did not immediately say, ah, Mary's pregnant. It's a miracle. It's a virgin birth. No, he went the most natural route immediately and said, she's been sleeping with someone else, or she's been raped, or something like that. Either way, she'd had sexual intercourse with someone other than him. It took a dream from God himself to confirm otherwise for Joseph. Joseph knew this was a miracle because he knew enough what the natural order was. Or consider walking on water. This might sound strange to some listeners, but in the ancient world, they built boats. Why did they do this? Because they knew people don't naturally walk on water. It didn't take too long to demonstrate this. Anytime someone stepped on water and then put their other foot out there, they sank immediately. This was a well-known fact. That's how they knew Jesus walking on water would be a miracle. They also knew dead people stay dead. They don't naturally come to life. And so, when Jesus shows up again, after being crucified, and when I say the crucifixion was a hideous, bloody event, he probably had all the skin ripped off of him, and yet when we see him resurrected, we have no indication that he's some bloody, mangled figure. In fact, it seems like aside from those scars, he's pretty well restored. That when he shows up then, they look and say, a miracle has occurred. It's a resurrection. Why? Because they knew science enough to know when the natural order has had an agent intervene in it. Now, I would like to stress something else. In a dialogue with an atheist this week, they seemed to think they'd really knocked down my belief in the reliability of the Bible by pointing out, for instance, that Sodom and Gomorrah, their destruction could be the result of a volcano. Or that there's natural explanations four of the plagues in Egypt, such as red tides coming in and such. And when I saw this, I said, I have no trouble with that whatsoever. Yeah, if there was a natural explanation for every plague that hit Egypt, I would not have a problem. And neither should you. Why? Because God is just as capable of acting through natural means without using unique miraculous intervention. In fact, this is something that we would instead call a second-class miracle. A first-class miracle would be something like the resurrection, where God specifically intervenes and does something that would not happen in the natural order. A second-class is using the natural order to bring about a miracle. But the miracle lies not in that this event happened. It happened when it happened. Another example, and one that I gave. When the children of Israel, in the book of Joshua, come to the Jordan River, they're getting ready to cross, the priests are taking the lead, and as soon as the priests step into the water stops flowing. And there is a clear path for Israel to go through. When the priests step back out of the water on the other side after Israel has gone through, the waters commence flowing again. Was that a miracle? Yeah. Has that ever happened before? Yep, it has. At least two or three times in the past, those waters have stopped. Some after this, some before it. What makes that time so special? What makes it special is that it happened when it happened. In fact, when I find these kinds of natural explanations, it tells me more and more, yeah, you know, the Bible did get it right. We can find historical times when this has happened, and it fits in perfectly. You see, one of the problems that you have when you encounter people who think the opposite way is what I refer to as fundamentalist all-or-nothing thinking. Either all of these actions in the Bible are direct first-class miracles, or none of them are. And that's just not the case. These all have to be examined on a case-by-case basis. Another example of how this idea is done is with the doctrine of inerrancy. Now, I do hold to inerrancy, but there is this strange idea often out there that if a Bible contains one error in it, none of it is reliable. And that is not a standard we use for any other ancient work. You know, I use the Bible. Now, I understand why some people put the Bible to a different test, because of the unique claims it makes about itself. But there's also something to be said about consistency, where you treat the Bible in the same way that you would any other ancient work. You give it the same kind of standard. In fact, it's been said, you treat the Bible like any other book in order to demonstrate it's not like any other book. And as we had Craig Blomberg on here a couple weeks ago, when you put the Bible to these kinds of tests, the Bible is capable of standing up. And if we really think that it can stand up, then we need to be able to show that and allow it to be tested. And when it comes to inerrancy, the atheist will often think he's shown one contradiction in the Bible. Usually he hasn't, but he thinks he has. And therefore, everything can be thrown out. But we have so many things in the Bible that are confirmed by sources outside the Bible. One we talked about with our guest Alan today. That's the crucifixion of Jesus. Even liberal New Testament scholars like Gerd Ludemann and John Dominic Crossan would think it's absolutely ludicrous to deny that Jesus was crucified. This is something that you find in Tacitus, you find it in Lucian, you find it in Mar Bar Serapion. And Crossan and Ludemon, they're not coming with this idea that the Bible is inerrant, but they're saying the Bible is certainly reliable right here. Even Bart Ehrman will tell you that if you want to know about the historical Jesus, the best sources you start off with are the four canonical Gospels that we have. There is no basis here for saying we are going to throw out everything unless we can find, if we find that there's one error in it. Now, this doesn't mean inerrancy is unimportant. I certainly think it is. But it does mean what I tell people in explaining this is, you don't want to marry your Christianity to inerrancy. In fact, you don't want to marry your Christianity to anything that's a secondary doctrine. I don't want people marrying Christianity with preterism. I don't want them marrying it with futurism. I don't want it marrying it with inerrancy. I don't want it to be married with a young earth. I don't want it to be married with an old earth. Your Christianity is based on the claim that Jesus rose from the dead. You might have to change your mind on other positions at other times. But as long as you believe that Jesus rose from the dead, you have the essential right there. You have the message that was taught. And we can so often say the youth are falling away because we're not teaching them young earth creationism, or we're not teaching them inerrancy. The reality is the youth are falling away because we're making these secondary issues so primary. Some youth is taught the earth is young, and they have that hammered into them. They don't have taught strongly Jesus rose from the dead. They're not taught how to make that case. But they go off to a college, and they find evidence they think is convincing. Otherwise, they say, well, the Bible was wrong. So much for Christianity, and often, strangely enough, they go, so much for theism, which, and I'm looking at them thinking, even if you disprove the Bible, which you haven't, how is it that that automatically disproves theism? How is it that you automatically know then that there's no God and you have your own explanation for everything that exists? It's that kind of indication to me that shows that there is a lot of emotional reasoning going on. If we're going to avoid losing the youth out there, we are going to have to make sure they learn these essentials. And it's also why, when it comes to these non-essentials, we need to present to our youth that there are various positions that people hold. If you want to be a young earth creationist, be a young earth creationist. If you want to be an old earth creationist, be an old earth creationist. If you want to be a futurist, be a futurist. If you want to be a preterist, be a preterist. If you want to be a Calvinist, be a Calvinist. If you want to be an Arminian, be an Arminian. I say, if you're going to be arguing for any of these positions seriously, though, at least be informed in your arguing. And I'd even say to a lot of you listening out there who might not be believers, if you want to be an atheist, be an atheist, okay? That's your right. You have that freedom. You can do that. I'm absolutely convinced you're making the wrong choice, but you know what? You can do it. All I ask is this. Be an informed atheist, please. Don't come to me with this kind of stuff that just comes from, say, a Google search or reading something on Wikipedia. Learn what you believe as well. And yes, I am fully fair with this. The church needs to learn what it believes in addition. If we're going to keep our youth who are falling away rapidly as soon as they step out of the church, if we're going to keep them, we need to be able to be giving them more than pizza parties and concerts. There's a time and a place for these things, but they will not make Christians. They will not inspire people to be holy. They might get people in the door, but we're not getting people in the door just to get them in the door. We're getting them in the door because we want to make them Christians. And in making them Christians, we want them to know why they're Christians. And we want them to live a life that Christ would approve of. And part of that means engaging the truth of Christ with your mind as well. And recognizing this is the greatest truth that is out there. This is the greatest revelation the world has ever known, and we need to know more about it. We've got about 20 minutes left. We're going to take our final break, and then we'll be right back.
This is Mike Licona. Nick Peters is my son-in-law, and I'm excited to announce his new podcast in which Nick will discuss and have guests on topics related to Christian apologetics and dealing with disabilities. Nick has already interviewed apologetic stars such as Greg Kokel and Rob Bowman, and I know of other stars he's in the process of inviting. So be sure to check out Nick's new podcast.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
We are back. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We've got less than 20 minutes, and we are available for your calls. The call-in number is 714-242-5180. I can remind you all, next week we're going to have John Walton come on. He's going to be talking about the lost world of Genesis 1. And I really encourage you to listen to this one, even if you don't agree with Walton's view after you hear it. I find it's one of the most fascinating views I've read on Genesis. It's really changed my perspective entirely. And we're going to be discussing some criticisms of it that have come in as well. One thing I can definitely say with this view that I really like is it helps us avoid the mistake that we make in our times of reading the Bible from our culture's perspective. And so much of the Bible we miss because we're doing this. If you know anyone who's an anthropologist, they tell you if you go to another culture, you need to realize that culture is different from yours and you have to take that into account. Well, getting a book from another culture is doing just that. Except this isn't just another culture. This is another place. This is another time. And this is another language. In fact, a number of languages. And if you read the Bible, assuming it's written in the style of, say, a 21st century American, you are going to be confused. You are going to miss a lot of things. And there are a number of people who have left Christianity because they've been thinking the Bible speaks as if it was a 21st century American document. It doesn't. Now, getting to this point also about engaging our culture and knowing what we believe and how pizza parties and such aren't the best, if we're going to be doing this, we actually have to be engaging the culture. It sounds like such a shock to people. We've got this mentality built into us that we are to isolate ourselves from the world. It's what I call the escapist mentality. It's when we meet Christians who say, oh, I'm just ready to get out of this world and get to heaven. Now, I have a number of problems with this. First off, on the positive, I will say every Christian should desire heaven. There is nothing wrong with desiring being in the presence of Jesus, being in the loving, manifest presence of Christ. There is nothing wrong with that whatsoever. What is wrong is when you act like nothing in this world matters, Finn. See, if atheism is true, then I say yes, nothing in this world matters. We're all going to die in a heat death. There's nothing beyond us. There's no good, no evil, nothing. If Christianity is true, though, everything matters. Christianity has something to say about everything because God is a God of everything that is. It has something to say about your job. It has something to say about your marriage. It has something to say about your sex life. It has something to say about your hobbies, what TV shows you watch, what books you read, what games you play. It has something to say about everything whatsoever under the sun. And it has a lot to say about what we do with this world. Now, it's my view that when the Bible says, "Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven," and that we have the New Jerusalem coming down to earth in Revelation, I think what it's trying to tell us is that this world is not created to be destroyed. It's created to be the place where God will dwell with his people. And God did not make a mistake when he created this world. Yes, a mistake happened in this war, but this world is not a mistake. And we are called to engage this world. Now, some atheists out there will start talking about the problem of evil. You know what? There is a problem with evil. But the oddity to me in this is that the Bible never goes against the problem of evil. It, in fact, admits right up at the start the problem of evil. As soon as you get to the third chapter, lo and behold, there it is, the problem of evil, the snake in the garden. And the rest of the Bible is all about how are we going to deal with it. It just seems like a stretch to me, then, to say, well, evil certainly presents an obstacle for the Bible, doesn't it? No, it doesn't. And as a number of philosophers have made the case, it's not an argument against the existence of God. In fact, for a number of us, it's an argument for the existence of God, since you need God to know good from evil. Now, recently, I read the book Atheist Delusions by David Bentley Hart. By and large, I think this is an excellent book. There is much in it that is incredibly fascinating to read about when Hart goes through history and shows how Christianity changed things, how the idea that Christians weren't tolerant of other cultures and such, that they were opposed to science, opposed to knowledge, and he just devastates this. And you won't find actually a lot of said about the new atheists, because to him, they're not really worth talking about. They're more of a symptom of a problem. But my disagreement of Hart came at the end, mainly when he said that he thinks it's too late for our culture. I understand a lot of people think that we are in a tough time. Morally, we've got a society that is just hedonistic to the end. We're just seeking how we can have a good time mentality. We've got marriage being under attack, and if you support and defend true marriage, you're a bigot, you're intolerant, you're hateful, you're a bully. Economically, our economy is on the verge of collapse. We're having a hard time politically trusting our leaders, especially in light of some recent events that have taken place. And then worldwide, we've got things like, oh, Muslims want to come in, and then there's concern about places like North Korea and Syria and other places. And we can look at it and think, what is going on in our culture? But I don't think that our culture is doomed yet. Now, I'm open to being wrong, but I don't think so. Why? Because I think Christ is greater than our culture. And if we're Christians, we should all realize the power that Christ has, that what Christ can do in each of our lives as individuals, he can do in the life of our culture as a whole. See, if you lived in the Roman Empire of Christ, you'd have, for instance, that little children, when they were born, if the father decided he didn't want the kid, for instance, if a kid was disabled or was a daughter, then you could leave the child out in the wild and let the animals devour the kid, and that was it. And the women didn't really have any say in the matter. They just had to go with what their husbands wanted. Christianity came into a culture like this. It came into a culture where crucifixion was common. It came into a culture where sex was on every single street corner due to orgies and mystery religions. And, for instance, the church in Corinth, it's been said the great miracle was that there even was a church in Corinth. Because if you want to talk about someone back then who was immoral, you could use the term Corinthian, because the whole society in Corinth was wicked and immoral. And Tacitus, he didn't have much to say about Rome itself. He said that's a place where every single wickedness comes to dwell. And you had events like the Gladiator Games. And these weren't people with a background of Christianity. Most of them weren't aware that they were doing something that was against, say, a law of God. They were just going about their lives and enjoying all this stuff on the side. And Christianity shows up and says, no, you're wrong. And they go and they convert the world. And keep in mind, Christianity had reached all the way to the Roman Empire without the aid of a New Testament. That didn't come about until more towards the second half of the first century. When Paul gets to Rome, there's not a New Testament yet. And some of the books had been written, most of his letters had been written, of course, but no one had compiled said books and said, oh, here's the New Testament. And yet, they were doing more evangelism and doing it more successfully than we are. And today, we have not only the New Testament, we have mountains of evidence that backs the New Testament. We've got scientific evidence that shows the universe had a beginning. We've got some of the best philosophical argumentation that's out there. We've got numerous texts of the New Testament. We have got so much that we can use to change the culture. The problem is not the information. The problem, in fact, isn't even the culture around us. I expect pagans to act like pagans. I expect secularists to act like secularists. The problem is us. We are not doing our job. I have stressed this so many times on here that Christ, in giving the Great Commission, told us to go out into all the world and make disciples. What's the message being given? The message is Jesus is King. He has all authority in heaven and earth right now. Every knee is to bow to him. Go out, spread the word. You know, this might surprise you, but that really wasn't a popular message. Rome wasn't too keen on the idea of hearing that there's another king out there. And Jews weren't too keen on the idea of hearing that Yahweh had brought about his final act of salvation through a crucified heretic. And this was the message I was going over. And they weren't going out there and just giving a message of Jesus will forgive you of your sins. Of course he will. But the reality is, most of them didn't care. Most pagans were not walking around wondering what they would do with a problem of sin in their lives. They thought, by and large, they were living pretty good lives, if anything. They were just trying to survive. Jews also weren't doing the same thing. They were not as antsy about the law as people think, living in terror, saying, I haven't kept this command, I haven't kept this command. They had a pretty good system of forgiveness set up. And they weren't worried about it. Heck, Paul himself said he was blameless when keeping the law. So it wouldn't work up to a Jew. You could say, have you kept the law of God? Yep. And you'd be caught fat for it then. But if you go up and you start talking about the resurrection of Jesus, that changes things. And let's keep in mind what the resurrection of Jesus is. The resurrection of Jesus is that which transforms everything. If you are living a transformed life right now, it is because of the resurrection of Jesus. And if you're not, maybe you need to look at how much you believe in the resurrection of Jesus and how much you're applying what it means to your life. And if you think the resurrection can change your life, where it can change the life of a person next to you or anyone else out there, do you really think that there is someone out there that if Jesus gets hold of that person, Jesus cannot change that person to be more like him? That's what he's doing with every single one of us out here. And if he can do that, he can also do that with the culture as a whole. So, if he can do that and he can do the culture as a whole, when is that going to happen? Answer, when we start doing what he told us to do. If we live in here in America and America goes down the drain, we're not going to be able to blame it on political elections, per se. We're not going to be able to blame it on the rise of atheism. We're not going to be able to blame it on Islam or Mormonism or anything else out there. You know what we're going to blame it on? We're going to blame it on the church. Because we did not do what we were supposed to do when our time came. So yeah, my wife and I, we're reading a book together now by a former pastor of hers. By and large, I think it's a good book. It's called Altitude by Michael Simone. So here's my little plug for her pastor. And recently we read about the book of Esther. Now, Esther is my favorite book of the Bible. It is a modern adventure novel, as far as I'm concerned. When I was given my Bible the first time and I got to that book, I couldn't put it down. It was just so thrilling. This is a fascinating book also because it's a book that never mentions God once. You won't find God's name in the book. But God is everywhere in the book. Because when you see the way the circumstances work out, you know that God is active behind the scenes. And Esther is described as a woman for such a time as this, that she came to power when she did, so she could bring about the salvation of her people. And that's exactly what she did. She risked her life in order to make sure her people could be set free. What does that have to do today? Because every single one of us out here in our own sense is an Esther. In Acts 17, we are told that it is a point of the times and places that we should live. Look where you're living right now. It's not an accident that you're there. And look at the time frame that you're living in. God meant for you to live in this modern time. Why? Well, that's something you're going to have to work out on your own. The reality is, unless you think he does accidents, which he doesn't, and if you think he does, you've got some serious issues to work out there as well, then God is able to use you to do something positive for his kingdom. If you think God can't use you, that doesn't say much about you, but it sure says a lot about your view of God. So I urge you then, start looking around you and find out what it is that you can do to change your world for the better. Whenever I've been going out lately, I've been having this request in the back of my mind and making it to God a number of times and saying, I want to go out there today and I want to do something. I want some opportunity to come up where I'm allowed to make a presentation for the gospel. Because I really enjoy what I do. Apologetics is the most thrilling career I could have asked for. And my wife can tell you, if she sees me getting ready to engage a skeptic online, it's practically like I'm on drugs. I am just so thrilled at that moment, I can hardly contain my excitement. And I love getting to read more and more and learn all that I can about what it is that I believe. And sometimes I get sad when I think, you know, we're given so few years on this earth. And yes, I, like you, want to be in the presence of Jesus one day. And I know I will be. But when I get there, I want it to be that I have done my work beforehand. I so want to hear the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." I want to know that I wasn't just looking out for number one, that I left this world a better place than I found it in. And I believe that is fully possible, but it's going to require my work. And I want that for you, because I can't do your work for you. I can't be holy for you. I can give you help here. This podcast is here to help equip you so you can go out into the world. I want you to take full advantage of this podcast. When you go to my blog and you read what I say, I want you to be able to fully take advantage of what I say and use it for the kingdom. It would be a great disappointment to me to know that everything I'm saying here is a waste here. It's going out and people are not engaging in, or using it to engage. People, we have a job. We can do it. And I'm going to be doing my part. I'm counting on you to do yours. Well, I've just been told we have about 60 seconds left, so I'm going to go ahead and be signing off. And I want you to know that next week, this time from 3 to 5, on Saturday, we will be having as our guest John Wharton talking about the lost word of Genesis 1. I look forward to seeing you here next week to quote the old TV show, the same bat time, the same bat channel. See you then.